From Brown Cow Studios in Gallatin Gateway, Montana, this is News Nerds. I'm Ezra Graham. Today, a conservative view of the April 4th Trump indictment brought by Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. My guest today, Peter Tichtin, was a lawyer for Donald Trump who worked on a legal case against the Clinton campaign, the DNC, and other Democrats. Tichtin and the other lawyers working on the case argued that the Clinton campaign leveraged accusations relating to Russian election collusion against the former president as the 2016 election progressed. The team of attorneys were fined more than $50,000 for their work on the case, based on a judge's ruling that the legal claims were only, quote, political grievances, unquote. Tichtin also wrote a book called What Makes Trump Tick, My Years with Donald Trump, From New York Military Academy to the Present, which explains his experience as Trump's classmate at the academy. We'll talk to Tichtin about Trump's indictment and arraignment, his legal practice in Florida called the Tichtin Law Group, and his political views. It's Thursday, April 20th, and this is News Nerds. Lawyer Peter Tichtin is a senior partner at the Tichtin Law Group. He started his career as a lawyer in Canada, but in 1985 relocated to Florida, where he practices law now. He was one of the lawyers representing former President Donald Trump, who he attended the New York Military Academy with, in a case filed against Hillary Clinton and the DNC. He's also the author of the book, What Makes Trump Tick? My Years with Donald Trump, From the New York Military Academy to the Present, which was published in 2020. Peter Tichtin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's truly a pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
So I want you to describe just the first time that you met Donald Trump.
Oh, I don't actually have a recall of that, okay? I mean, it would have been on the soccer field because he was in a different company. And I do think that at that time he was in my English class because we only had 12 students per class. And I'm pretty sure he was in my English class as well. But at that time, it's not like meeting somebody. It's, you know, going into a classroom, sitting at a desk and hoping that you can basically figure things out and get through it, like every high school student. But we became close. I mean, well, I'll tell you, there was an episode, there were things that did occur before, but we actually got close in my senior year when that was when we were both 17 years old. He was my captain, and he decided to take a chance on me, made me his platoon sergeant of his first platoon. For most of that year, we worked side by side on making sure that everything worked, because when you're in a military academy, unlike most high schools where you go home at night, or most boarding schools where there's somebody that checks on things, here we were subjected to inspections on a daily basis, except for Sundays. Saturday's inspections were white glove, where the inspecting officer would basically be wearing white gloves and he'd rub them on the top of your locker, and God forbid if there's any dust that's up there still that you haven't cleaned up before. So, and we were able to run the company with a perfect record for that year, which is kind of phenomenal, but that's what we were able to do together. So in a sense, we worked well, but you know, people ask me, what kind of a guy was he? And I remember him so well as just being this really great guy, this really wonderful person. And I try to figure out, well, why do I think that? And I've remembered some things about him. You know, for instance, like every single day, except for, you know, Sunday, there was mail. And cadets are kids, you know, we're between the ages of 15 and 19 in our particular company, in our section of the barracks. And, you know, there's some kids that didn't have, you know, we call ourselves men, you know, I mean, okay, men, you know, follow me. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that we were, some of us didn't have parents that were sending cookies or sending mail or sending different things to us. In fact, some kids never heard from their parents. And I remember him so well being and dealing with these issues. So, you know, he knew who was getting mail, who had a family that cared, and who had parents that were absent. And he, He just had this way about him. He would just turn certain things that were otherwise untalkable, unspeakable, but he would basically turn it into a kind of a joke or say just the right thing that would bring comfort to whoever it was. And then there was no privacy. I mean, even in a modern men's room, you go to anywhere, you'll find that there's panels that separate the showers or what or the toilets or whatever. But this is just wide open, and you had to get used to that really fast. So a team comes back from sports, and there's two shower heads. People are in and out, and I suppose it happens still, but that's the kind of environment we were living in.
So what do you think when you hear something said, maybe by somebody like Mary Trump, who basically says the opposite of what you're saying?
Well, Mary Trump has a profit motive. I have only the motive of being truthful and being right. If Donald Trump were a bad player or something like that, what would, I've been saying these things from long before I was his lawyer, before I got paid anything from him, and he's not paying me now. I've got no motive in the world. If he were a bad guy, if I didn't get along with him, if everybody didn't really respect him at that time, I wouldn't be saying these things. But Mary Trump is a liar, and I know she's a liar personally because she says that he had somebody hired to come and take the SATs in his place. Well, I took the SATs with him. There were only 100 of us in our class. We all knew each other really, really well, and we knew all the teachers. So if the teachers that were proctoring the exam or monitoring the exam, if somebody came up to one of them and said, "Hi, I'm Donald Trump," I mean, they would know that the person's not Donald Trump. So it's what Mary Trump has to say is dishonest and false. And I know it for a fact because I was there.
I know that you weren't really intending to go into law, for a little while. So how did you start your path towards a background in law?
I was supposed to be a doctor. My father was a doctor. My brothers were doctors, and so I was able to get on a, my, but my real ability, what I really was good at was science and math, which would be great for a doctor. I excelled in those in school and I got into Columbia University, but then I got an opportunity to go to the University of Western Ontario in Ontario, Canada, where my father's family was all from Canada. My father was a New Yorker when I was born. So it became known that my brother could go there. And anyway, to go and be with my brother, I went up to London, Ontario, and started there. I was able to skip my first year of college that way. And then I did well enough that I was able to skip my last year in college, and I was in medical school when I was 20 years old. And I did that year of medical school, but frankly, I felt I kind of proved my point. I got into medical school. That's what I was supposed to do, but I really didn't want to be a doctor. And a friend of mine showed me some cases that a friend of mine who was in law school showed me some cases that he was studying. And I started reading these cases, and I, to me, it just fit. It was just, I definitely like the study of law much more than I like the study of medicine. And having the background that I did, it served me well. I mean, it still serves me well. I mean, I've dissected a human body with my own hands, taking a year to do it. I studied physiology, biochemistry, epidemiology. So, these things are part of me now, and they lend themselves to being the lawyer. And then I read a book by Ethel Bailey, The Defense Never Rests. I read a book from Louis Neisser, which was My Life in Court, and I got so enthused about being a lawyer. I went over to the law school in the middle of my year of medical school, and just by chance, somebody told me to talk to this one professor. He brought in another professor. I didn't know it. I was talking to two-thirds of the admissions committee, and they told me that I should get my application in the next morning. They'll accept me the next afternoon because my marks were up there. If you can get into medical school, you can get into law school. And then I had this meteoric rise in Ontario when I started my practice of law there, because in my first 6 months, I took on the traffic ticket I had a guy who was charged for careless driving. And it's too long of a story to bog down this interview, but just to make it short, I was able to defeat the ticket. So every case in the province of Ontario, the day people were supposed to go to court, they didn't have to go to court. And every judge in the land was saying case dismissed, stamp. And every single case that was outstanding was dismissed, and they had no tickets to give people tickets. So for something serious, they can give them a summons, but they couldn't give them this uniform ticket that was for more than just motor vehicle. It could be drunk in a public place, you'd get one of these tickets. But anyway, they don't exist. And then it took them a long time the legislature had to actually approve a new form. It took them like a year and a half to do it. So it was Ticton's ticket, and I got a lot of publicity for it, and I had this big rise as a criminal lawyer. And then because of my interest in global warming and my realization that it really was something that was real, I decided that I would buy a farm and start to farm and learn how to grow food and learn how to do what farmers know how to do. And that was a 10-year plan. Then I was going to go back to the practice of law. It took me 15 years, but I'm back to the practice of law.
I'd like to talk about the intersection of your career as a lawyer and then also your views and opinions. Have you ever worried that your political views, which I think are pretty well out there by now, would influence your law practice at all?
You know, it's always a concern. But, you know, to thine own self be true, you know, as Shakespeare said in Hamlet, or wrote in Hamlet, you know, yes, it's affected my practice. And I need to basically bring this up now in voir dires when I have a jury trial, and I do a lot of jury trials, you know, if anybody hold that against me, that I support Donald Trump, I represent him, that I went to school with him and know him since we're 15. And I do get people that find it can't be fair because of their dislike for me because of that. And I don't know how many that don't say that, but, you know, the fact of the matter is I win trials, sometimes lose them. But, you know, the fact is that that's the most important place where it would affect me. As far as gaining clients, I'm very lucky that way in life. I have a lot of wonderful clients that stick with me, and that I have new ones. People leave as well. We get the case finished up. But, you know, as many as I lose because the left won't want to come in my door, I probably gain because those that are more conservative understand that I understand them. I share their values. And I'm not one of the crazy people.
Yeah, you were suspended twice in 2009 and then 2010. Before I introduce you, you were talking about kind of how that happened. But could you explain, you know, the process of how that happened?
Yeah, sure. One of my clients had started a company called Link. It was a package delivery business, kind of like a very, 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 very small FedEx or DHL or UPS. And so he eventually was able to get the remnant of a company called the Pony Express, the last remnant of the one that started in 1860. So that had great value as far as I could see. And I was helping him as his lawyer, but because of the $20 million that he stole from innocent investors from Link that I had nothing to do with, because of that, he got charged and he knew that he was going to be arrested, and he needed somebody to take over the company. He couldn't find anybody who would take over the Pony Express. In fact, when I took it over, it was a mess. There was no bank account. Everything was done by cash with this guy. He was the criminal that he was charged to be. He ended up getting 20 years in federal prison for what he had done. But meanwhile, I took over the company, and I was working to get him out of the company with him to see what we can arrange so that he would give up his interest, because I couldn't find any investors that would invest with him in the company. And I testified at his bail hearing that he was not a flight risk, because I saw him he came down from Canada knowing he was going to get arrested. But one day in the jail, when I visited him, he said, you know, because I'm a foreign national, because he was from Canada, he said, they're going to put me in medium to maximum security. And I could see the fear in his face. I knew when his feet hit the ground, they would be running. So I had to basically withdraw my testimony that I gave at the bail hearing because it was true as far as I knew at the time I testified, but now I knew it wasn't going to be true. And the judge, his name was Wilkie Ferguson. He was a great judge, but he was also a friend of mine, and he knew that I wouldn't lie. So he would have believed me, and I would have been setting him up for embarrassment. So I needed to send a letter, that said I withdraw my testimony. And then I went back to the jail. Paul Johnson is the guy's name. He wouldn't talk to me. So that was done. I came back to my office. I told people, look, because I represent him, I cannot act against him. I need you guys. You're the vice president. You're the treasurer. You take care of everything. I need to have a wall between me and them, whoever you get, to deal with getting him out of the company. So they did it. They got him basically out of the company. To this day, I don't know what they did or how they did it. And I wrote a letter to the shareholders when that was done saying that he is out as out can be. Okay. Well, that was where I did something wrong. The letter I had to send, that's understood. And the bar rules and everything else, rules of ethics required that I do that. Otherwise, I'd be reinforcing false testimony then, now knew to be false. But the judge that heard it, the referee, he thought I should have an admonition, which isn't even a reprimand. It's the slightest penalty. But the Supreme Court of Florida disagreed entirely. They thought what I did was egregious. And I can see that because, you know, when you represent somebody, you have a very high duty to that person. And it's a duty of loyalty. And it could be conceived as a great betrayal to that person when you're writing letters to the shareholders saying this person is out of the company, is out as out can be. And so I did something wrong there. But I was always honest. It's not like I stole money from my trust account or that I lied about anything in any way, shape, or form. In fact, my honesty in regard to anything I did and my honesty in the proceedings were used as a mitigating circumstance. But the Supreme Court said they're going to use this as an example to show that if you have a conflict of interest with your client, they're going to teach the bar. And that's what they basically put in the decision. And they did say what I did was egregious. And I can understand that point of view. But meanwhile, while you're being examined, they're looking at anything and everything else. And they discovered that I had paid a referral fee to a New York lawyer that was located in Florida. Nothing that I did was immoral. Nothing I did was dishonest. But I had these two things. So I got a 15-day suspension for the second thing. And the first thing was doing what I thought was the right thing to do, protecting the investors. And I never got a penny out of that whole deal. I put 3 years into that company, poured all my money into it. And it eventually went under because we had four hurricanes in 2004. And they destroyed my customer base with the Pony Express bus customer base. So, you know, we have $1 million a month of expenses and 200,000 a month of revenue. It couldn't survive it. So that was like one of the worst things that happened in my life. It wasn't as bad as losing someone you love. It was a horrible thing. Most of the judges that read the decision and understood exactly what had happened, they would be every day, my lawyers would be going to court and coming back and they'd see me and they'd tell me that, Judge Weinstein says hello, he gives his best. And, you know, it was among the bar, among the lawyers, that most people understood and accepted that I really was not a bad guy, that I didn't really act in such a way that I should be shunned. And I have been running at 90 miles an hour in a 30-mile zone ever since.
And then you got, well, sometime later, but recently, you got involved with a case against the Clinton campaign and the DNC and then other members close to them, I guess, is how you would describe that. And this is after the 2016 election, but the case is about the Clinton campaign. And you argued, along with several other lawyers, that the Clinton campaign had tried to basically stop Donald Trump from being elected president. So how did you get involved with that case? And I should mention that you also got, you and the other lawyers on that case got fined for your work on the case. So I guess there's another, you know, bad thing that happened there.
Right. And a judge saying that what we did was terrible. And that's Judge Middlebrooks, who is a dedicated jurist. Okay. I mean, this is not a man who's dishonest or improperly motivated. He's a decent, honest human being. The problem is that he only sees one side of the coin. You know, he doesn't realize that Fox News exists. I'm sure he doesn't watch it. I'm sure he doesn't watch any of the other media. I'm sure he doesn't watch your show or listen to your show.
Yeah.
You know, because he only sees what he's being told from a very reliable media that is no longer truthful. So he believes in a certain scenario, and he believes, I don't know what he believes exactly, but, you know, he thought that we had this wild fairy tale that was being presented for political purposes. And it wasn't. It's a real lawsuit and with real legal purposes.
Well, could you explain what what it was based on, what facts the case was based on?
Sure. It was based on, you know, this Russian collusion that we should all know at this point after Mueller never existed. So, you know, we've got Hillary Clinton paying millions of dollars and the Democratic National Committee paying millions of dollars to have this BS thing made up of dossier that exists. The dossier is real. And the dossier didn't come about because of spontaneous combustion. It didn't come about because somebody wished it and it just magically appeared. It came about because somebody paid people to do dishonest things. And those dishonest things meant making up this false narrative. In fact, it went so far that they had different kinds of people that deal with computers that were making computers talk to each other as though Donald Trump or the Trump organization was part of it. It was all made up. It was all false. And they used this to get FISA warrants so that they could then basically eavesdrop on everything that Donald Trump was doing in his administration by going after an innocent guy. The whole thing was, to say it was dirty politics isn't enough. It was all highly illegal. It was criminal. And we were suing. That's why we had a RICO count on it. And that's why it was a real wrong that was done. And if the courts won't accommodate people, I mean, the judge that dismissed this thing, dismissed it with, where there was a motion to dismiss, the judge is obligated to treat the facts in the complaint as true. But he knew that none of this was true because he doesn't watch any news other than what's on the media. This is why when Donald Trump says that the media, and meaning the false media, the fake news media, is the enemy of the country, or the enemy of the people, it is. And the reason it is because people rely on this and they form their beliefs on it. So you take a good man, a good, honest guy, he became a judge probably because he really loves the law, became a judge probably because he really wants to do good. And he watches the fake news and he thinks that the fake news is the honest to God truth. So, of course, anybody who's saying these things about Hillary Clinton couldn't possibly be correct. And that's the problem.
So your case was basically that, you know, instead of Russian collusion, basically what the other side was arguing was that the Russians had tried to help, you know, Trump become president. You were kind of arguing the contrary, that Clinton and the campaign had made this up to, you know, make him look bad. I want to go to...
No, not exactly.
Okay.
Let me just correct you.
Yeah, explain.
It wasn't that the Russians tried to help Trump, because maybe they did. I don't know. Trump doesn't know. Maybe they did something to try to help him. The problem is they were alleging that they were making a case. They were making false evidence that there was collusion with the Russians between Donald Trump and the Russians. And that's where it was crazy. It was just crazy. Donald Trump had absolutely no connection with it. Look, when the Mueller Commission, they got together, they were how many lawyers? 20 something lawyers. They spent $30 billion. They knew there was no Russian collusion from the very beginning because there was no evidence of any. So they were looking for any kind of criminal activity that Donald Trump could have done because, you know, they're figuring that everybody does criminal stuff because they're criminals. Okay. In the words of George Bernard Shaw, you may be too young to remember who or know who he is. He wrote Pygmalion. He was an author. He's the guy that said youth is wasted on the young, said a lot of really neat things. One thing that this man said was that the punishment of a liar is not in the least that he cannot be believed, but rather that he cannot believe others. We all look at life through our own prisms. And if somebody thinks that you're a liar, it's probably because they are, or it's a great potential that that's what it is. These people that thought that they had an insurance policy, that they would be able to nail Donald Trump, didn't understand that this man, he's a billionaire. He doesn't need to do anything for money that's illegal. He doesn't get his kicks doing illegal things like some people do. He's clean. So they spent $30 million and they came up with zero. They don't have them for spitting on the sidewalk. They don't have them for anything. So, that's where this thing went to, taking an innocent man and trying to do whatever they could to make it look like he was a criminal, including making false evidence and presenting false evidence to the FISA court.
Donald Trump has been involved with a lot of lawsuits in his career and time, as working, I guess, in New York, and then now, as a former president. Do you believe that he did any illegal actions, not even just based on the lawsuits that you've worked on or that have, appeared in the past decade? Do you believe that he's done any illegal activity?
No, when you do illegal things, usually somebody else is involved. They're sooner or later going to come forward to get the kind of money that Mary Trump that you mentioned earlier. That she wanted the money. People want money. Sooner or later, things come out. The lawyers have a saying: the truth will out. It's nature. It happens. The truth does come out. How much can you hide? And he doesn't have a trail of people that he didn't have to murder somebody or have them appear to have committed suicide in jail, or he doesn't have any of these kinds of skeletons in his closet that have no, nothing has ever come out about him. And why? Because he doesn't need to steal. He doesn't need to do anything illegal. And he doesn't get kicks out of doing things that are illegal. He's a straight guy. He's a choir boy.
So I think it's pretty clear that you don't agree with this latest case in Manhattan. Could I play a clip that you I think was just released? It's called Tickton Talk, and I just got it from the PR
Oh,
people.
yeah.
I'm gonna play a little bit of this clip just for background. It starts out, you're making this video, and then you go and kind of compare what's happening right now to the sport of boxing, and you say that you compare this case to politics. I think it will become pretty evident, where you're going with this when I play the clip, but here it is.
You can wind up here in the fight game we call politics. So sometimes that rough and tumble, anything goes, contact sports creeps in, takes stock of us here, then lures us away from the quest for truth, the loftiness called justice, and drags us here into the jab, slab, rough and tumble political ring where even the most capable, most honest and innocent can get bloody noses and sometimes flattened. So how do boxing promoters like some politically motivated criminal prosecutor in New York draw a crowd? They target, of all people, a hero of tens of millions of people, a world champion, former president of the United States. That's how. And I call it not boxing, but political theater. Stunt time. It's a witch hunt that's pitting a former criminal, this guy. Read his book, and after you'll want to take a shower. He's a professed liar. Once a lawyer, now lying about his former client, a former president who never paid nor authorized him to pay hush money to a former stripper and porno queen one stormy day.
Okay, so that was a clip that you just released called Tickton Talk. And I'm just gonna explain a little bit more of the end there. When you referred to the liar, you were claiming that that was Michael Cohen, who has been convicted of crimes, and now and it was because of his work for Donald Trump. And he said that, you know, Michael Cohen said that Donald Trump paid hush money to Stormy Daniels because of a relationship that they supposedly had. So now we see this, you know, new case in the Manhattan DA's office. Politics aside, do you think that it's a strong legal case?
No, it's not a strong legal case, but there's a strong jury pool.
Right, because it's Manhattan.
Because it's Manhattan. It's not as bad as Washington, D.C., but it's almost as bad.
So it doesn't seem like you're that optimistic.
I mean, well, you know, the thing is, I'm optimistic because I do believe that, well, first of all, these are petty, stupid charges. Okay, this isn't a charge for insurrection, something that could affect them politically. These are nonsense charges in comparison. This isn't something that people do jail time for. This is like parking tickets, higher than parking tickets, but lower than shoplifting, I would say. All you need is some right people that can stand up to public pressure on that jury. And I believe the jury is going to be unidentified. So nobody's going to be able to go after anybody for deciding anything that these people don't want them to decide. So I think there's a really good chance of prevailing. But then again, it's been many decades since I've done criminal law. It's not something, I have not spoken to the president about it. And when I speak about all of this, I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking on his behalf because I really don't know. But I do know him. This is just not a person who does things that are wrong. You know, he's a decent, honest man.
Do you think that this case will be good for him politically? Because I think a lot of people are saying that that might be the case. And, you know, people on both sides of the aisle, left or right, let's just say that those are the two parties we're talking about right now. You know, some people are on both sides are saying that this is not the best legal case, but it still might, you know, benefit him politically, especially as he is running for president again in 2024.
Yeah, there again, I was just speaking for myself, and I'm not a political expert as such. I haven't been trained that way or, you know, had a career in political work. But it seems to me that people are reacting to it in a way. I mean, this man has taken it on, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or, you know, basically he's been taking this on. And for years, I mean, you know, first it's one thing, then it's another, there's Russian collusion, then there's the impeachment things that come up, and there's one thing after another. He's constantly under such terrific attack. I don't know how he has the energy and the strength to present himself the way he does. I mean, he is a rock. If these people can keep getting away with what they're getting away with, then we've already lost this country. At this point, we need to get it back. And, you know, the odd thing is, and the strange thing is, most people that I know think we're going to be in war with China before too long. This never would have happened. The Ukraine never would have happened if Donald Trump was still in power. And the one person that could fix things, because we know, and I don't mean like a fixer like Michael Cohen, you know, I had in that short thing that you were talking about the fact that you'd want to take a shower. That's because when I read his book, and I only read half of it because I just couldn't stomach it. But when I was reading his book, every time I put it down, I really did feel slime. That this guy, Michael Cohen, is a slime ball. The fact is that you've got an innocent man and he's being charged, and that's enough to activate his base more because they see the injustice. And that will end up giving him some political points.
I'd like to talk about your personal views. You know, I think we've you know, covered the latest lawsuit pretty well. And, you know, I know that your views on climate change are complicated. So I'm just going to try to maybe summarize what I've heard you say on interviews. So I've heard you say that, you know, you believe in climate change, but you don't believe, you know, what the left is saying or what the right is saying. You kind of have a different opinion than everybody else. Do you think that, like the political parties, the established Republican and Democrat, you know, political parties, does it annoy you or frustrate you when conservatives or Democrats around you talk about climate change in a way that is just so, you know, tailored to that political party's needs?
The conservatives, the Republicans, the right are in denial about global warming. By the way, you said, I believe in global warming. I don't believe that it's a good thing to believe in facts. Okay. I think facts, you have to look for evidence. And you might have heard me say before that belief is the enemy of knowledge, because if you believe in certain facts, you stop looking for proof and evidence. But, you know, believe in faith, believe in God if you want. If that's what you believe, then that's great. There's nothing wrong with having beliefs. But when it comes to facts, you should look for evidence. So when it comes to climate change, global warming, I understand the science. And it's not something I believe, it's something I know. It all boils down to scientific principles that I could explain in a heartbeat to you right now, just to make it really clear. It's not that there's a greenhouse effect. There's no glass over our atmosphere. What it is the fact that there's carbon that's being put into the atmosphere. And if there were no carbon in the atmosphere, the oxygen and nitrogen in the that would be left does not hold heat. And at night, when there's no sun, it would all just dissipate and go up. It'd be like 200 degrees in the day, and it'd be minus 200 degrees at night if there were no carbon dioxide. We need carbon dioxide in our atmosphere because that's what makes life possible on Earth. As we're burning all of these fossil fuels, we're putting just so much more of it there. And it's sort of, if you think about two logs in a fire, anybody's ever made a campfire, anybody's ever had a fire in a fireplace, knows you don't build a fire with one log. You build it with two or three logs, because then they radiate to each other. And that's what carbon molecules do in the atmosphere. It's as simple as that. So if the more pieces you make, the more effective they are as what they call a greenhouse gas. So the best way to take this chunk of coal and turn it into the most number of pieces is simply burn it. Every single atom of carbon breaks off and joins with two atoms of oxygen. And then they're all there and they're all floating around. And carbon dioxide is a little heavier because it's carbon, but it still floats around. It weighs about 1.5 times the amount of the oxygen and nitrogen mixture. So in any event, that's what's going on. And we're pumping 20 million barrels of oil. I mean, America is, the world altogether, 80 million barrels of oil are burning a day in this very thin atmosphere that goes up just a few miles. So it's a problem. The right are in denial and the left are crazy, but they're crazy about everything else they're doing. It's not thought out. There's problems with electric cars. First of all, we can't add 160 million electric cars to our grid right now. Second of all, even if we could build them, which we can't, you know, the fact is that the electricity comes from turning an internal combustion engine. So you're going to be burning that much more coal or oil or natural gas, making all that much more carbon dioxide gas, because you're now charging batteries. But the more transactions you have along the way, the more loss you have. So an engine that directly turns a wheel is going to be much more efficient than an engine that then turns a generator, that then charges a battery, that then it goes through a transformer, then travels through high voltage lines, then goes through another transformer, and that goes to your house, and then charges a battery, and the battery then has direct control. It powers the motor then to turn the wheels. Every aspect of that transaction is a loss of energy. You know, what worries me is things that I hear that I have no evidence of whatsoever, that some people are thinking in terms of geoengineering the planet by lowering the population. That would be crazy. But I will tell you that there are two different kinds of people that could be running this country. You take Donald Trump, he's a person who basically, his focus is, his concern, his care is about the people that are in the United States or the people on Earth. The left, they're not concerned about the people, they're concerned about the planet. And so both of them could be altruistic and think that they're doing wonderful things and work forward with a sense of righteousness. Because if you're saving the planet, you're going to save some people. And, you know, these people are more acting out of fear than they're acting out of logic. Because there's other ways of geoengineering the planet. You know, if we put our resources together, we could find ways of blocking some energy from the sun, maybe over the Pacific. Whether, you know, we got a moon full of dust. And if we're going to go to the moon and we have a space force, we could make a circle. We could make a ring around the earth that would lower the amount of sun's energy that's hitting us in parts where we don't want it to hit us, which would lower the temperature. I'm not saying that this has been all worked out in science and by scientists as to how to go about it. I'm just saying nobody's looking at these ideas. Nobody's doing anything like this. It's either denial or let's replace everything with solar panels, which is impossible, with windmills, which is impossible. And for some reason, they don't want to touch nuclear, which doesn't, none of it makes sense.
Do you think that, you know, when you said the Republican Party is in denial, do you think that Trump could be mixed in with, you know, the Republican Party?
You know what? This is one topic that I don't know why, but we've just never sat down and talked about. There are other topics too, but I mean, this is one topic that we never discussed and that, you know, I would like to have a talk with him, but I'm sure that while he was president, he was learning. And I don't think he is necessarily in the same kind of denial. At one point, he thought it was a hoax. And to a great extent, it is a hoax. Believe me, there are a lot of people that are profiting and making really big time money, you know, whether it's Al Gore or whoever. There are hoaxes that are going on. But at one time, that's what he was saying about global warming. He hasn't had that way of describing the problem in more recent years.
How often are you in contact with Trump?
I don't know. It's now and then, you know, maybe once a month. You know, it's not like, you know, right now I don't have active cases going. I'm waiting for the appeal to reverse the Hillary Clinton decision. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right now it's in front of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. I do believe it'll get reversed, as will the penalty, the sanctions that came against the attorneys. You know, so there's no real need for me to visit, although I have, and we'll see what goes on, what transpires going forward. But right now, I've got to concentrate on my practice of law, and also, you know, I've become a little bit of a public figure. I think some of my views are important to be heard because, you know, we haven't even touched on what's really going on. I guess I did touch on it when we talked about global warming and the, you know, the far left and what they're going to do, what they're planning, and how they might want to geoengineer the planet. But I also made it clear I don't have any evidence to that. It's just that there's a lot of people with, again, beliefs. You know, we're not realizing that the world is not like the 4% of the population that live in the United States. The other 96% of the population are not spoiled and fat and slow and stupid like we are. They're you know, a good example of this would be Putin. I mean, who would believe that an educated man, somebody that has as much power, as much wealth as he has, would think in terms of, let's send some missiles over there and blow up these buildings that have people, that have children, that have, you know, all kinds of people, all kinds of ages, and let's kill those people. You know, I mean, how brutal can they get? But, you know, see, the thing is that people aren't like us. They aren't like Americans have become, which is weak and conciliatory and wanting to just have everything peaceful and friendly. Men have become so much more feminine. You know, we've just gone to a different direction. But the fact is we're living in a false world. We don't understand that there are people like Putin and Xi. The winds of war are blowing our way, and we're not understanding what that is. Donald Trump and I, we were born within a year of World War II. We were still, as children, having to deal with air raid drills, where we had to get under the dashboards of the cars or hide under our desks. And we knew not to face the windows because the glass from the windows would go right through our eyelids and through our eyes. These are things we were taught as young children. This is the environment we lived in. When we lived through the Cuba Missile Crisis, everybody knew that any minute these missiles could be raining down on us from above. And we were all frightened from it. We were all living it because we knew it was real. Now, people talk about the subject, but they don't realize it. And so we're sitting there as we're basically winding ourselves down. And hopefully our military isn't going to be so woke that they're not able to respond. I mean, look, let's talk about hate for a second. I don't think anybody in our audience is going to disagree that hate is a bad thing. You know, in fact, hating anybody just burns you yourself. It's been said that to hate is like drinking a cup of poison, hoping the other person dies from it. So hate is a bad thing. And hating people because of race or national origin or whatever kinds of artificial differences there may be, or real differences there may be, the fact of the matter is, it's a bad thing. But if everyone in the world thought that way, we'd be fine. The fact is, though, that we never would have won World War II if we didn't have hate. It's hard for a soldier to have compassion for somebody that he has to shoot and kill. If you're going to kill people, it's a lot easier to do that when you hate them. So, you know, if you look at old movies or if you look at, you know, what was going on in wartime, you know, we were talking about Japs, dirty Japs. I mean, we loved them before when they gave us the cherry trees that they gave us in 1912. Or if you look at them now, and we love them now. But at that point, there was hate. We've lost our hate like a porcupine loses its quills. But a porcupine without quills is not going to be able to survive in the wild. And I'm not advocating hate, but what I'm saying is we need to understand that those other people have that hate. And we need to be able to understand that it's real, it's palatable, and people will do things like invade the Ukraine and kill massive numbers of innocent people because they have this lack of our mentality for a better world.
Would you define yourself as a Republican or a Democrat?
Maybe as a Republican, definitely as a conservative, definitely as a Trump supporter.
Okay, well, Peter, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was my interview with former Trump lawyer Peter Ticton. He has a law practice in Florida called the Ticton Law Group, and he can be found on the web at legalbrains.com. Is produced and hosted by me. We're on the web at newsnerdspodcast.com, where you can catch up with past episodes, subscribe to our newsletter, play our crosswords, and contact us. Find News Nerds on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and while you're there, please leave us a review. We're also on community radio station KGVM every other week at 5:30 p.m. Mountain Time. They're at kgvm.org or 95.9 FM on your radio. Consider supporting them by going to kgvm.org/support-kgvm.